Do y'all know who Stephen Miller is? Yeah. Well, for those of you who don't, he is the senior advisor for policy for President Trump. He was the architect of the administration's child separation policy, the policy that demanded that we pull nursing infants as young as 4 months old out of their mother's arms, and that now means that many children will never be returned to their families because the government didn't bother to keep the records necessary to reunite families once they were separated. So, Stephen Miller, he came up with that. Stephen Miller also reportedly developed the plan to carry out the upcoming blitz of mass arrests of undocumented immigrants in sanctuary cities. Resistance to that plan was part of the reason Kirsten Nielsen and others at the Department of Homeland Security were recently forced to resign. It was too much, even for them, the people who implemented child separation. Where do the separated children and the people who are arrested by ICE go? They go to what we euphemistically call detention centers. Historically, there is always a euphemism. No government ever speaks about such camps truthfully. And for those of you who haven't been following the news, in the camps, people are kept in standing room only cells with limited bathroom access. They go without food, water, and clothing. Medical care is withheld even when children and babies become unresponsive. Sexual abuse, including abuse of children, is unchecked, and we don't have clear information on how many people have died there. The government recently argued in court that people in the camps don't need toothbrushes or soap. Author Bradford Pearson recently said that he asked one of the sources for a book, a survivor of the Japanese internment who regularly visits our immigrant detainment facilities, how the two compare. And the answer was chilling. He said, "Brad, it's worse than anything we ever experienced." I was at a stoplight in DC recently, and I was the first car at the light, and I saw someone who looked an awful lot like Stephen Miller. And I'm pretty sure it was him. I wasn't completely sure because it wasn't an encounter I was expecting, and it felt a bit surreal. But I saw him walking on the sidewalk, closer and closer, and stepping off the curb. And then Stephen Miller crossed the street about 5 feet in front of my car, alone. And afterwards, I found myself wondering if I had been certain it was him, what would the moral thing to do be? What if I also knew that someday he would incite genocide, as I truly believe he might? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a great theologian and martyred Nazi resistor who willingly returned to Germany despite having the option of safely remaining in New York to teach, wrote many pages on the immorality of killing. And yet, he helped with plots to kill Hitler. Bonhoeffer did not offer an ethical or theological justification for this. Instead, he wrote that he was taking guilt upon himself and hoping for God's grace. He recognized that he could use many rhetorical tricks to justify murder to other humans, but he was rightly skeptical of the moral truth of such justification. Over the past few years, I've been unsettled to find that many of the things that previously seemed incomprehensible in the stories of genocide have begun to make intuitive sense to me. The statement by Germans that they didn't know about the camps suddenly seems less baffling when I see people willfully choose to ignore our situation in favor of distracting entertainment or encase themselves in fact-proof bubbles. The incomprehensible speed at which survivors of the Rwandan genocide say neighbors turned against neighbors seems less outlandish as social norms shift beneath our feet. Hannah Arendt's observation of the banality of evil was illuminated for me as I watched a Justice Department lawyer looking and sounding like nothing so much as a bank teller from Cleveland. Apparently not extraordinary in any way, blandly arguing that people don't need sleep. After the light turned green and I drove away, I was surprised to find that I wondered if I would come to understand Bonhoeffer's choice too. Ultimately, though, I have always been a pacifist and I continue to be one. I don't believe in the death penalty or war. I even save spiders from my husband's wrath. Nonviolence is woven deeply into who I am. Not unrelatedly, I am a universalist. Universalism is the basis of our faith. Our forebears rejected the icy condemnation of Calvinism in favor of a vision of a loving God who would redeem all people. That trust in the inherent potential for goodness in everyone continues today in our seven principles. I'd argue that it's even more challenging and more powerful now because we don't speak about salvation as something outside of this world. After we've moved beyond all this complicated life stuff, we have to grapple with what it means in the here and now. The lure of believing we are what Calvin called the elect can be strong. We want to think that we're morally pure. We don't bear responsibility for the camps. They're the result of those bad people over there. If only those people were eliminated, it would all be okay. I don't think that's true. I don't believe that the individuals responsible for planning atrocities are blameless, but we all play a part in allowing our leaders to lead. And someone would have filled their place, so long as that was the type of leader we would accept. I don't see Stephen Miller or any of those responsible for this as unique or special. They've come into power because all of us, in one way or another, to one degree or another, made it happen. Could child separation and the expansion of the camps exist if our culture didn't trivialize and dismiss sexual violence so much that multiple credible accusations are not considered disqualifying for public office? What about mocking a disabled journalist? Without widespread ableism, would we be where we are? If Islamophobia didn't run rampant, if LGBTQ people were accepted as full and healthy members of society, would the electoral process have been so compromised that the many politicians who now stand in the way of democracy could have won without neglect by millions of people over decades? And if you can truly say that you have never fed any of those forces that brought Stephen Miller to his role, if you came into this world blessed with a perfect understanding of every form of oppression, never inadvertently reinforced a single one, and never wasted a moment of life that could have been devoted to building a better world, watching The Apprentice, for example? Well, maybe you are one of the elect. The rest of us need grace. I believe in grace, whatever that is. And I have hope for Stephen Miller. In fact, there is nothing he can do that will make me stop having hope for him. He has an infinite potential for goodness, and I will not let my belief in that goodness be taken from me. The opposite of a world where babies die on hot, dirty floors because America is in the thrall of white supremacy is not a world where we who see the evil in that make our own list of undesirable people to be eliminated. It's a world where we have hope for others, for our own redemption, and for a better future. To be clear, this is not a call for moderation or centrism. Moderation and centrism have their place in a political life where the center is reasonable and kind. And we left that behind long ago. If it was ever the case in America with its self-image so at odds with its history. When Donald Trump said that there were, quote, good people on both sides of the Nazi marches and violence at Charlottesville that left Heather Heyer murdered. And when he recently excused his call for the execution of the now exonerated Central Park Five by saying those same words, refusing to admit that those boys, now men, were innocent. We should recognize that kind of rhetoric for what it is. An attempt to move that which is monstrous closer to mundane. Moderation is not what we are called to. The middle ground between children being systematically abused and children being treated as the unique and precious beings they are is not an acceptable outcome, and it is not one that I have an interest in. This is not a call for moderation. It is a call for something much more radical than simply identifying our enemies and fighting the other side. Our church's role is to speak from what the Reverend William Barber calls the moral center. From the moral center, we can recognize the suffering in those camps and the abject evil being perpetrated while also recognizing the humanity of the perpetrators and our own culpability. The moral center leads with love, and love is anything but moderate. One of the things I've begun to see about why good people often don't throw themselves in the path when the most terrible atrocities begin is that it isn't a lack of concern. What I understand now is the paralysis of deep sadness, a sense of helplessness, because we can't ever take back what has happened, and more terrible things are piled on faster than we can respond. Some things cannot be repaired. We bear responsibility. We are grieving. But in times like this, good people are called to be prophets. Every ordinary good person, all of you, you're called to find your moral center and side with love. So we need to find a way to be with more sadness than we had before, to take our sadness and our rage and transform it into the wave of change that it can be. And time is short. I believe that the key is grace. Forgiveness is the province of victims, not witnesses, certainly not witnesses who contributed to the victimization occurring. But grace, whatever that is broader. Grace can give us the strength to do what's needed by allowing us to hope for the perpetrators of evil, by giving us the self-compassion needed to accept responsibility for what we should, and by allowing us to return to interconnected wholeness instead of requiring that we be among the elect. After his escape, Tibetan Buddhist master Fakya Rinpoche wrote about his experience in a Chinese camp. He said, I quote, "I feel tremendous compassion for them. Moved to tears, I pray for them more than for anyone else. In appearance, they were the torturers and I the victim. But in reality, we were all victims. I was their physical punching bag, and they were the victims of their own uncontrollable, destructive emotions. Every day, I offer them my prayers so that they may free themselves from mental states upset by hatred and anger. May we all find the wisdom to embody grace so fully. May we recognize our shared humanity with those who do harm and respond to their actions boldly, but with love. May every child in the camps be safe and well. May they be free. Amen.